Good morning again. The title that I have is Learning from Great Teachers of the Past. I hope that all of you have had good teachers. And I think you have, if you think about ways that you've learned and people who have impacted you positively and so on like that. And so what do we think about when we think about great teachers of the past? We sort of maybe compare and maybe we think about really great teachers. Because we're humans, we're going to root it in our own personal experience. I thought I would start with giving something from my personal experience, and I'm going to just move on and go to just a little bit more of a classical approach. I was blessed to have a number of good teachers, but not very many. And the one that I had the most taught me both in my lower grades and my upper grades. Sister Nancy is what we called her. She later married and has children, and I had the privilege of teaching her children. I had a rough seventh grade. And it's one of those difficult things that in the middle of the year, you know, as a student, things aren't going quite right and you're not 100% sure what to do about it. But the teacher's contract or whatever was terminated in the middle of the year. And then the school board asked Sister Nancy to come back and teach, going, you know, she'd kind of gone from lower grades to middle grades, and now here are the upper grades. And it was a big deal, and we could go into a long way. But I, looking at that from the point of a student, I remember that first day in January of school starting up again very well. I have a pictorial memory, and so I can remember some things very clearly, and I have a very bad short-term memory, so it's a problem. But anyhow, a good pictorial long memory. And then the funny thing about this is now I look back at that picture as a teacher, and I realize that she was scared to death. It's just there, but I didn't see it as a seventh grader. What I remember was being impressed with this pleasant expression, and we tried to sing hard, and it was terrible. Actually, she about fainted, I think, when that horrible sound that came out of those adolescent voices and so on. What I did is I went through and I'm going to give some examples of great teachers of the past and then give some lessons from their life and from their teaching. In this case, I would say this. Great teachers smile when they are scared. You remember that? Great teachers smile when they're scared. And that's a lesson that I take from that experience. In Galatians 3, toward the end of the chapter, Paul says that the law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. Now, the word schoolmaster can kind of lead us a little bit in the wrong direction. We think of a schoolmaster as a teacher, but that's not what that actually was. He was a servant who would escort the son, the privileged son, who gets an education, from the home to the teacher, and they were to keep that child safe. And it's a brutal world. I would imagine if they didn't, their life could be on the line. And so it's one of those bad deals when the servant has to be in charge and at the same time is subservient. So difficult, you know. That was the role of the law, to bring us to Christ. Christ is actually the teacher, right? And that it was his primary title in his earthly ministry was that of teacher. When you read in the King James Version, master, that word isn't referring to owner. It's more connected to the Italian maestro, a teacher of tremendous excellence, right? And in Greek, it's just teacher, your normal word for teacher. So that's what people called him, teacher, teacher. What about this? And it was just really a great introduction what Brother Uwe had about remember Christ and all those pressures, things that we could never, never really live under that kind of pressure. We should realize that, right? We need to back off a little. But he was a master teacher. He was academically learned even at the age of 12. We know the story. And those masters of the law that he was confounding were brilliant men. You study Talmudic pedagogy. I'm not saying that word right, but anyhow, learning and teaching. It's huge that they what they had to learn, what they memorized. And this 12-year-old is confounding them, and he's not confounding them with teaching at that time. He's confounding them with questions, which is, in a way, down their line. He knew things. He was academically learned. And yet, at the end of that story, what's the focus? I need to be about my father's business. This is a 12-year-old speaking. In life, he knowingly lived in such a way that it would inevitably lead to a specific death. It was a life that was a holy vocation, which he embraced single-mindedly to do his father's will. Single-mindedness is really one of the great challenges of our day. What do we think of someone who wasn't single-minded? I think of Martha. Dear Martha, who's busy laboring around and chiding her sister and kind of Jesus too. And he says, Martha, Martha, you are cumbered with many things. If Martha was cumbered with many things, what would Jesus tell us? Because we're much more cumbered than Martha, really. Single-mindedness is difficult. In the story of the sower, which we heard about, one of the great kind of things that sort of rips at my heart is the good seed fell in good ground, and it was growing, but it was choked out by the cares, distractions of this world, and also of the desire for wealth. And we live in North America. Those are real things, distractions and issues that are connected to material wealth more than what we realize, and we even realize it. We can be distracted by some evil things. We can be distracted by things which have really no moral value in and of themselves, and we can be distracted by good things. Remember, Martha was distracted by serving Christ. And sometimes we're a little hard on her. We shouldn't be. Jesus embraced his mission single-mindedly. What is our mission? What is your mission? What is my mission? We all need meaning. We need significance. We need to know that there's a purpose that's called man's greatest need. And you want to read the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I don't know how you can read that and not be moved. But we need meaning. And so there is a sense of purpose and a sense of mission that is in each one of us. And to a certain extent, we know what it is. There are some things beyond our immediate control, and we're in this situation. This is our mission for the day. This has been a bit of an inspiration for me, because talking about weariness in the morning as I get older, and I'm not even very old, but already the sleep issues are plaguing me more than what they used to. You know, you could actually work late into the night because you could be assured of sleeping well. You just slept well. That actually becomes less easy. You might not sleep well for no reason at all. And different things. Where I teach school is, of course, during the winter. As the days get short, they get really short. In the shorter days, daybreak is about 10 o'clock. Sunset is around 3. That doesn't mean that there's no light before or after. It's twilight. And, you know, it can be actually just kind of getting light as the school day begins at 9. When Linda brings the children in the morning, it's dark, right? Darkness is kind of oppressive in a sense. And as we sit at my desk, those mornings are just very precious to me, actually. But one of the prayers I often pray is that, God, you've given me this day. This is why I'm here, right? This is why I live. So help me. Embrace that mission. And there are lots of issues as we face children and so on like that, and we work with them. And in Bay Tree, I have the privilege of working with younger children than what I've ever worked with, and with older children than I've ever worked with. Young people, I shouldn't call them an 18-year-old 19-year-old is no longer a child, right? And that brings both challenges and privilege and interest. And what do you read for story? some of these things, this is kind of good. Embrace that mission. We should realize that single-mindedness does have a dangerous side. It's called obsession. And we've heard about teachers who can only talk about teaching. And we've all been around people who have something, they've had a great experience in their life. It's the only thing they can talk about, and we get so weary of it, right? Let's talk about a different country than Romania, maybe, huh? For 10 minutes. Okay, something along that line. Single-mindedness can lead to unhealthy and wrong obsessions. A suicide bomber is single-minded. Okay, Jesus didn't become that way, and of course he didn't. But we can learn from that. In his full embrace of the Father's will, he cared about temporal needs. He cared about people who are sick, who are not feeling well, and we heard again, that was just a great introduction about that. He took children on his knee and he blessed them. He held them, and this was counter-cultural. In ancient literature, children are not spoken of positively. The people wanted them, they wanted sons, especially they wanted their names to move on, there were some just horrific things, actually, that were involved in child training, child raising. I'm reading a book right now called The Kindness of Strangers, which is all about child exposure in the ancient world. And I knew it was huge. I knew it was big, but I did not realize there was the amount of evidence that there is for that kind of a practice of abortion was difficult, so you actually expose your child. That means you leave your child on the street or something like that. It was a big problem. Jesus took time for children. So here's my second point. Embrace the mission. Secondly, great teachers embrace their mission. Secondly, in embracing the mission, great teachers become generally better. They become generally kinder, generally compassionate. They do not ignore the urgent, but they're not ruled by it either. The problem of, sacrificing the important on the altar of the urgent. Maybe that doesn't make sense to you, but there's actually it's a real issue that we can face where we go from one emergency to the next, to the next, to the next. Actually, we lose our long-term goal. So, but they cared. Jesus was generally good, and that should be us. We should become generally interested in children, in young people, in issues, for no other reason. Not because we're going to impact them for the rest of their life or that they're going to do something wonderful to us, just because this is where we are at this moment. Moving on, another teacher that we don't often think of as a teacher, and yet maybe we do, and so it won't be too much of a surprise if I talk about the Apostle Paul just a little bit. I'm really blessed reading 1 Thessalonians lately. I've been reading some of the Pauline epistles, and I love the idea of the Gospels, of the epistles. Put yourself in the story. Think about what's happening. Think about why was he writing and caring about things. And in this case, the words that were leaping out to me in the first and second chapters of 1 Thessalonians, and I read slowly through this, were words like toil and labor and night and day, and we worked with you. We worked with you. And we cared so much about you that we were not imparting only the gospel, but our very souls. We were concerned. And he talked about that of course, right before Thessalonica was the episode at Philippi when he had been, in Thessalonians, he used the word shamefully treated, right? They were lashed. It was a big thing. They sang that night in prison. It wasn't something Paul forgot and forgave. I hope he forgave. I think he did. But he didn't forget it. It was actually a brutal experience. He later had to leave Thessalonica because he himself was the catalyst for riots in the city. And we're talking about citywide riots taking place because they're looking for Paul. And if he had just stayed away, maybe all this trouble wouldn't have come. And I think that bothered him to an extent because he wasn't wanting to cause riots, right? And the church even said, yeah, please, it's time for you to leave. Maybe that's a bit bittersweet. Maybe it wasn't. He left. But he's talking about this, that we were caring very much. And later he hears through his team that, you know what, they're now experiencing persecution in that church. And he's wondering, did we labor in vain? Was our toil in vain? And so he sends Timothy back to find out. And I think he probably took a little bit of a letter with him. There are writings of Paul that we don't have. And Timothy comes back and he brings us the gospel. Actually, it's a verb form. He gospelizes us. Your situation would be a literal translation. He tells us the good news that you are well. He uses the word for gospel in that. And the joy that's in his heart then, when you read back over that, you can see what he was and you can see what he was worried about. Now you can see that he's rejoicing. Now there are some things to work on. But he is so happy about this. And he said, we could not bear it anymore. And how happy we are that you are enduring and you're realizing that to suffer for Christ is our calling. Embrace the mission. How much have we suffered for Christ? We have to kind of leap through some hoops sometime to get there. I think we do, but maybe still leap through hoops. There's an element of risk in helping to prepare others for life, in trying to point them in the right way. People can and do reject what they have been taught. And it's devastating. It is heartbreaking. And then you as a teacher can be blamed for it. And sometimes we blame ourselves. And I think Paul probably struggled with that a little bit. You can read that between the lines, that he's wondering, did we labor in vain? Did Paul ever labor in vain? Yes, he did labor in vain sometimes. Not everybody followed what he said. He suffered. We also get the concept that great teachers work and they teach passionately. This is work. That's just all it's to. It's work. And to top it off, we don't even reach around sometimes. We don't even do a very good job. So it's work. But great teachers teach passionately. Great teachers are also resilient. Telemarketers are not the only ones who experience mass rejection. That can be overstated. As teachers, we don't always experience mass rejection. But it can get old sometime where it seems like you're constantly pulling them in a direction they'd just rather not go. And like I said, it's not a constant experience. And I know in some of my years have been more that way than others, and definitely with some of my students. And I have some students who have, I don't know, been very forgiving with me, but have also kept that relationship open even after creating some difficulty. And things happen. They come back. The relationship is still open. So there's a resilience there that you, with your words and with the expression on your face and with the way that you finally do obey unwillingly, can trample me. And you can do it again and again and again. But you can know that you can come back. And I'm always going to be here. It's just you do it. This is our calling. Great teachers are resilient. The determination to smile, to keep an even keel and just keep on going without bowing to pressure, to give in, without bowing to, because that's the easy thing sometimes, just finally forget it. I had a student that had a problem with saying bad words. What do? I could have led to her expulsion. And there were a number of difficult issues that were related with her life. And so I know the balance that I took was that I didn't. I talked to her parents, definitely. I talked to her, definitely. And I could never hear it without rebuking it. And that led to another problem, okay? And then back and forth we went. And, you know, it would have been just easier if finally she's not coming until she straightens up. A high school student on top of that. Today, you know, I know she depends on me. And there are, her story is a long way from over. But I'm glad I didn't. On the other hand, there's a core in my heart that I wondered, you know, I don't really know that I did the right thing either. I wonder. I second-guess myself. As I get older, I second-guess myself more than I did before. But I do know this. You hang in there. You might not do the right thing all the time, but you don't give up. And they know it. Another teacher, Origen. Maybe most of you have heard of Origen. Maybe few of you have heard of Origen. Origen is actually an interesting man to me. Early church teacher, controversial teacher. I cannot read his writings without being amazed at his knowledge of Scripture. And I could talk a long time about that. But he was a teacher. He taught students. He taught them both in the academic disciplines of the day, and he taught biblical disciplines from the Bible for instruction classes, what we would call today baptismal candidates and that kind of thing. And that was a 3-year course, essentially, where he would go over the entire scriptures and he would preach a little sermon every morning before they go off to work. This is when they come to hear it. And so his sermons take about 15 to 20 minutes to read through. And that's what they were expected to come for. And sometimes they were tired and they slept. And you could hear the exasperation in his tone. And because he had a patron, there were scribes there writing these things down. And many of them have been lost. There's supposedly if all the writings of Origen existed, it would fill just the titles that we know will fill a whole book, right? Many of those are gone. But we have some. I've been inspired by him. I'll tell you a little story. Gregory and his brother Athenodorus were from what is today northern Turkey. They were escorting their sister who had been, they were kind of from a big, high, noble family. You know, they were escorting their sister. They were going to go to Beirut to study law, Roman law. They're one of the great centers for that. They're escorting their sister to Palestine where her husband had been appointed as a legal advisor to the governor there. They pass through. They come to Caesarea, which is the capital of Palestine, the Roman capital of Palestine. And there they hear about this man Origen who teaches. And somehow Origen grabbed on to Gregory. And I don't know about his brother Athenodorus. You don't hear much about him after that. He taught. Gregory stayed there, and he taught him for 7 years. So this is kind of the equivalent of a college education. Gregory was not a Christian. He becomes a Christian and during this time. And he leaves and goes back to his native town of Neo-Caesarea, which is today Niksar. The story there is, and this is partly legend, but he was ordained bishop. We know that. The story is that when he was there in that town, there were 17 Christians. And when he died, there were 17 pagans. That's a little bit too neat. But there was a massively effective ministry that went on to bringing the name of Christ to that region, and somewhat superficially at times. That's another story. But at any rate, Origen writes him a letter during one of these times. And he talks about him that, listen, in your service of Christ, it's like the tabernacle. The tabernacle was filled with instruments of gold and silver and immensely costly things. And where did that come from? It came from Egypt. When those children of Israel spoiled the Egyptians, they went around asking for their wages that they hadn't been paid for years, and the Egyptians cheerfully gave it to them and asked them, please, please take it. Please be satisfied. The treasures of Egypt finding their way into the tabernacle, right? And he said, what it is there are things that you can learn, and then you apply in the kingdom of God. You can use that to in your work. That has been an inspiration to me as I have read many non-Christian writers, and especially about teachers. You can read about Rafe Esquith with Teaching as Though Your Hair were on fire, that kind of thing. It's an inspiration to me. The first 100 days of school, you got that? You know, they're great things for us to learn. There's a very controversial teacher from Toronto named Jordan Peterson, who just wrote a book called 12 Rules for Life, an Antidote to Chaos. Yeah, he's lost his job there at the University of Toronto, which is an amazingly prestigious school. One of the things that he talks about is that always assume that the person that you're talking to has something, knows something that you don't, that is helpful for you. That's actually really good. Just assume that when you're speaking to somebody, there's something here that this person can know that would actually help you. That's good for you to know. Jesse Stewart, Tori Hyden. I think every teacher of disabled children or difficult children or whatever ought to read the books by Tori Hyden and at least some of them. A lady who pioneered creative ways in helping children with sometimes very difficult problems. She was not a Christian. She did not live. In my opinion, I don't think she was promiscuous, for example, but she wasn't living within the New Testament standard. But she loved her students, and she had a tremendous degree of integrity in working with them and a tremendous degree of commitment to their lives, including one time a student calls her. She's in somewhere, forget where, and this student calls her from California, and she drives to California to pick that girl up. You know, heavy stuff, and amazingly successful with what she did with children that were considered mentally retarded beyond the point of any learning anything, did learn things. But it took a lot of patience. A wholesome curiosity with humility can go a long way in just learning to find out what people like, and you can learn a lot of things. I have to keep going, but I would say this. Whatever's going on in your life, there are fine things to be inspired about, and then pass them on to your students. Don't bank on things that you heard a year ago, 2 years ago. Find out, live the life, and then share it, right? Observe, listen, read, share, talk, discuss, pass it on. Be inspired, and that takes some work sometimes. Like I said about happiness, sometimes you have to act happy, and then you become happy, right? another educator, John Amos Kamensky. I'd just be curious, how many of you have heard of him? Okay, so I'm a church history nut. I'm a little bit familiar with him, and I became more familiar with him. In English, his name is Comenius. He's called Comenius. He is the father of modern education. He had a haunted and persecuted life. He watched his church. He belonged to a radical group of Christians that stemmed from the teachings of John Huss, and they were very familiar, very similar to Anabaptists, but they were actually had an older tradition than the Anabaptists yet. He was persecuted. His books were burned, and his house was burned, and he was shunted from one place to another. And in the middle of all this persecution, his church is disbanding, and he was a leader in it, and it was just like his life is going to nothing. And yet, he loved children. He loved truth. He loved Christ. He loved children. These three things come clear to him, and he taught passionately. Our concept of school organization, where you have kindergarten, lower grades, upper grades, high school, college level, that all comes from him. And then the concept of grades, where you have a grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. He said, this is how you should do it, where you have circular things that are going on and you teach them, advance them every year. Normally, they were used to the idea of tutors and that kind of thing, and finally they get to where they're good enough to go to something else, you know, a higher grade, like a college, what we would call a college, but that was all different. So that system comes from him. And he was asked to set it up in England and in Holland and even in Austria-Hungary and indirectly in America. It trickled down through that. He was the first to effectively use picture books. His book, Orbis Pictus, which was a way of teaching Latin through pictures, was the best-selling textbook for many years, and so on like that. He's also the first one to really push and influence influential people with the concept of universal education. We wonder, well, what does that mean? Is it public school? The concept of universal education is that every child should be educated. Everybody, whether they can afford it or not, there should be a way that every child can learn to read. And it was based on his very strong belief that every child is inherently valuable in and of themselves. For the fact that they are a human being, they are valuable. It doesn't matter who their parents were or what their baggage they have in their life. Every child is valuable. The concept of no child left behind, we've heard that, you know. That comes from his teachings, and he ended up being immensely influential in these areas, and yet he lived such a difficult life. And incidentally, where I knew of him first was as a devotional teacher and writer through some of his writings. He lived in from 1592 to 1670, so it gives you an idea of that. So something I learned from him is great teachers see both collective and individual needs. You see the needs of the group. You also see the needs of the individual. You know where they are and what they need. They are resolved to resolving large issues, as well as helping each student that comes under their sphere. Secondly, great teachers teach creatively. What do I mean by creative? Not just kind of neatly and inspiringly. Creative is the idea of building things, where you teach productively and you say things that you like, that you move, that you want to see. And it's a difficult issue with us. I've heard it's said that the three great hallmarks of Anabaptist theology was non-resistance, non-conformity, and non-accumulation. They're all nons. How about radical love for all people? How about an embrace of godly values that you live in to show that you're a Christian in the world? How about radical generosity, right? All these things can help steer us in the way that we should go to be like Jesus, not just what we should not be, right? And he pushed for that, creatively find something. And in his use of pictures, that was different. It's a little bit like if you cannot learn from a classic text how to speak these classic languages like Latin, which is what united Europe, then that you have no business trying to learn. That's not for you. You're dumb. So don't try it. He said, teach children. You can teach them. Use pictures. Yeah. And that little cute little book that I have, I almost brought along, but I'm so tight for space and I didn't want to have a check-in. So I didn't. But look it up sometime. Orbis Pictus, which is just Latin for pictures of the world. Okay. A few words about, we have to talk about Christopher Dock a little bit. My daughter, Veronica, who's one of the major balancing points in my life, said, Dad, you're not going to talk about Christopher Dock, are you? Everybody talks about Christopher Dock when they talk about great teachers. Yeah, I'm going to talk about Christopher Dock a little bit. It's inspiring to me that he is considered the father, or one of, or if not the father, of American education, specifically colonial American education. I learned a few things that I hadn't known before about him. That he emigrated to the colonies in 1714. He was born in 1698, so he must have been about 16 years old. A young person, right? He must have had some kind of intellectual educational bend. He starts teaching in 1725. He teaches for 10 years to 1735, and then it's time to do something else. Make some money, get some roots down. He's going to become a farmer. That's what successful people do. And he farms for 3 years. And then he quit and goes back to teaching from 1738 to 1771 in his death, which is a long teaching career. I had to wonder, why did he quit farming? I don't know. I wonder if he was a poor farmer. It just maybe found out it's actually more difficult than it looked. They say, you know, teachers have to be careful. We have a little bit of a sob party sometime about how we're paid and all that kind of thing. And then when it comes on to it, we're no good at anything else anyway. So, no, he impacted an amazing amount of people, and we know that, right? That was his calling. That was his gift. He embraced it. I'm glad he did. And we shouldn't be embarrassed about that. In some ways, I would love to be a businessman, but my gift is actually teaching, and that's what I do. Several things. If you read through his stuff, you'll see some quaint things and all that, but there are some beautiful concepts, and one of them is this. Discipline is never intended to hurt the student because the student hurt me. And we get angry with children sometimes. We can get frustrated. We can get upset. And it's just you're not cooperating, and sometimes they indeed are not. All of this, you don't hurt a student with your words, corporeally, whatever, because they're just not with it. The point of discipline is to form character, good character, lasting character. A point that I wanted to say, and I'll say it now quickly, is that this. If I often, and I've worked now with a number of co-teachers, and some of them are just beginning, and so I'm kind of like the mentor, all right? One of the pieces of advice that I give over and over again is this: never forget your children grow up. That's pretty phenomenal when you think about it. I've had that experience. Now I know what it's like. Children grow up. They become adults, and they never forget how you made them feel. They never forget. They might not even remember what you taught them. There's so many things we all forget, but they remember how you made them feel, and they remember being under your authority, and whether they chafed or not, and that kind of thing. They do grow up, and so for you wonderful young women who teach the lower grades so well, don't forget it. First graders actually become adults eventually. So do second and third and so on. Seemed like he understood that. Character lasts, and he was working with that. And he tried very hard to correct and build good character. Many of you have heard of the book Skipack School, right? You've seen that. So you kind of catch the love that he had for dear Eli and some of those things. Another thing I learned about him that I thought was interesting is he was tremendously good at the art of Fraktur. It's kind of a German, Pennsylvania, German style of art, and it was basically, it reminds me of medieval biblical illumination, where you have like a plaque and then you draw all these beautiful little lines on it and you write this beautiful calligraphy for a blessing, for a housewarming, for a gift to somebody, for a baptismal certificate, and then there are lots of little pictures, tiny little pictures, in this thing. And so it's a labor. It's a lot of work to make one of them. He excelled at it. And that's one of the things he would often maybe teach his students a little bit, how to do it, or he might give them one, something like that. And those today are worth a lot of money. You never know. That was fascinating to me. So great teachers discipline their students intentionally and carefully. That's a big subject. I'd love to tell you some stories about it, but I will say this. Learn to differentiate between chronic problems and spontaneous problems. And a chronic problem needs to be met intentionally. Where you finally don't just respond, this is enough now, okay, and over. Always, once a chronic problem has become a problem and you're working with the parents at resolving it, when a child is disciplined for a chronic problem, that child should know well in advance exactly what is going to happen. There is no surprise at all. I'm going to stop. But maybe I'll tell you just a tiny little story. By the way, students care and teachers care and love their children. That's also illustrated by Christopher Dawkins. Reminds me of another beautiful story that happened this past year to me. But I'll give you one little story about discipline. We play hockey where I am. And I don't know if there's any game that brings the passion out quite so strongly. And we play it a lot. And I had a young man who played hard. And he loved to win, and he hated when his team lost, and he hated when his team lost repeatedly. And so what he would do is he would chase the puck back and forth after it's time to go in, which they needed to come in. After I said it's time to come in, you leave the puck alone or put it into the goal, and that's it. And he just couldn't. I finally addressed it. I kind of scolded him, talked to him about it, and told him, listen, if you do that again, this has been a problem, and I said this publicly to him after everybody had kind of was there because he was doing it in front of everybody, and this is becoming an issue. if you do it again, I'm going to keep you off the ice for an entire day. And you might be upset enough now to think, I don't care, but you will care then, because, you know, and you would have. You will not be allowed to go on the ice. I'm going to say, it's time to come in. I'm not going to shout at you. I'm not going to tell you to quit playing with the puck. I'm going to say it's time to come in. And if you do anything else other than put the puck into the goal, you're not going on the ice the next day. And then I insisted that he responded back to me. Do you understand? Yes, he did. He was terribly upset. But he did. He answered. And then I also told him in the middle of all this that this isn't for the rest of your life. It's just till Christmas time. It's between now and Christmas, if it happens between now and Christmas. So keep parameters within your discipline. Don't tie yourself into a box where you're going to have to fight with this thing now for the rest of your life. I would have done that every day from then until Christmas if I'd have had to, but I didn't need to do it once. He knew clearly what was going to happen, and he stopped. And it did happen again a few times in January and February and March, but not very often. So clear discipline with clear predictable results, with the idea we're molding character. Children grow up. God bless you.